Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And we have reached the finale, the glorious finale of our off-season podcast position rankings series. We are at quarterbacks today, and this is, this is emotional right now. Can you feel that, Andy? Can you feel it over the telephone wires?
Yeah, not really, but we do this because it's good off-season fodder, and it's been good. I think it's fostered good football discussion. I hope it does today. And the actual stuff is going to start here soon, which is nice. Not the preseason, we're going to have to tread through that. I don't know if you remember, but I would not let Klemko and I talk preseason last year. I think it's a waste of energy. So we'll talk other things, but there will be actual football news during the course of training camps the next few weeks.
Yeah. Stuff is actually happening around the league. It's nice. It's that it's that feeling you get on the hot summer day. That's what we have around here, where you're standing in front of the cold pool and you're not sure if you want to jump in. But then once you get in, it's very refreshing. That's kind of the stage we're at right now with the off season wrapping up at the MMQB.
And the jumping, that's training camp to you? That's jumping in the cold water
there
and going?
Go. That's a metaphor, yeah. Andy.
Yep.
Heavy stuff here at the top of the show. I'm a little emotional. I'm not sure if we're going to talk after this. You know, will we keep in touch? Will you keep in touch with me after this is all over?
Not the way. It will never be the same. But that's all right. We're good to go here.
Well, I guess we do have to record a new show next week. But anyways, we have reached the final position ranking. This is quarterbacks this week. I will actually give this spiel for the last time, and I'll mean it this time, because I wouldn't be surprised if some of you are listening to this series for the first time, since, you know, who cares about anything but quarterbacks? But we have done every position in football, except for kickers and punters, because Andy has no respect for specialists. I have love for him. Andy does not. But we have done everything. It is up on iTunes or Stitcher or SoundCloud. You can find all those shows there. The way we do this ranking is AP poll style. Myself and Andy and Jeff Irwin, our researcher, submit our polls of the top 15, and you get 15 points for a first place vote, down to 1 point for a 15th place vote. And Andy's votes count double because he is that smart. But with that, we will jump right into it with our others receiving votes. We have Alex Smith, Derek Carr, Matthew Stafford, and Kirk Cousins. And I was going to make a Johnny Manziel joke, but I won't. Mostly because I just wanted to see if you were listening to the others receiving votes. But Andy, when you hear those names, anyone you wanted on your list? You actually went 15 for 15 now that I look at your list. All your guys made the list.
Did they? That's good. I'm actually surprised Manziel didn't make Jeff Irwin's list, our researcher. Who, if you are listening for the first time, Jeff Irwin has been the disruptive force on the list. He'll do a thoughtful player, thoughtful player, thoughtful player, horse crap pick, thoughtful player, horse crap pick. And that's about the pattern that his lists have been going so far. He didn't do that this week as much, though.
It's like improvisational jazz. That's an Irwin list. He really keeps you on your toes. You don't know what's coming next.
You know what, jazz? You know, the secret of jazz is everybody likes it for about 2 minutes, and then they think, God, this is all the same. This is just bagpipes without bagpipes. Jazz music gets very tiring very fast.
Oh, man.
I like the idea of jazz music. I think people like the idea of jazz music more than actual jazz music.
I do, too. I have a brother who's I'm not going to say he's a jazz musician, but he has a great appreciation for jazz, so I feel like I should be in his corner. I guess I really don't have any strong feelings about jazz. So yeah, of those four guys, we actually had, we've had some wide-ranging differences in votes here. We had, four guys here who are, they all got 3 points or less. Alex Smith, I gave a 13th place vote to, and that was, that was pretty much it. That was the only one. I think Alex Smith is up there. I appreciate Alex Smith as... And I hate to bring the name up because he brings up a lot of strong emotions in people. But if you take Tim Tebow, who obviously is a, he's a zero. He's a non-contributor in the passing game. But
yeah.
You factor in, he doesn't take sacks and he gives you a little bit in the running game. Now, obviously, that's not what you want in a franchise quarterback. But if you take someone like Alex Smith, who is much, much, much better than Tim Tebow, obviously, and nothing against Tim Tebow, I think he's a very nice guy, let's get that out of the way. But Alex Smith gives you a little bit in the running game and won't make mistakes. You know, he won't give you any negative plays. So I think he's the ultimate game manager. I had him 13th on my list, so I guess I will feign outrage at this point that Alex Smith did not make our list.
Well, I like that you call him a game manager, because that seems like it's become, I'm going to write in my Chiefs preview, it's almost like it's politically incorrect to call anybody a game manager now, and especially Alex Smith. It's like it's ignorant of you, you're stereotyping somebody, you're stuck in the past. He's much more than a game manager. How can you not appreciate him? And the truth is, he is a game manager, and so the discussion isn't is he or is he not a game manager, is it okay that he's a game manager? And I think it is. I think for what Kansas City does, he works just fine. Only just fine, though. And I don't think he's anything close to a top 15 quarterback, because what you don't see on TV are all the throws that he should attempt that he does not. The guys that are left open. Deep intermediate guys that get open on time within the structure, the play design. There's a lot of football, good quality football, that he leaves on the field, and his pocket presence is very poor. If you just watch him in isolation, he doesn't scan the whole field. He'll bring the ball down when he goes from one progression to the next, or he'll needlessly break himself down in the pocket. Those are big-time problems to have. They get hidden by the fact that he plays in such an incredibly well-designed offense under Andy Reid. And Smith, to his credit, reads coverage as well. So he does let the simple part of the play designs, the easier reads, the easier throws, he lets those go just perfectly, right on time. And so the offense can stay on schedule. But the Chiefs could be so much more than they are with Alex Smith at QB. And they could be less, too. And look, you're right. He doesn't throw interceptions. That's the plus side of it. What we're talking about, though, to me, is nothing close to top 15 type quarterback. This is vanilla football at best.
All right. Well, I'm getting angry here, Andy, so we'll back off of Alex Smith for a moment. But I'm actually going to circle back. I'm just going to thread Alex Smith through the show every time you discuss a guy, and I'll sort of bring
okay.
him up.
Fair enough.
What about Alex Smith? But yeah, I'm going to bring him up again in about 2 minutes here, maybe like 3 or 4 minutes. But we will go into the list right now, starting with number 15, Jay Cutler. He was he got a 14th place vote from you. That was the only vote he got. I had him as my 16th, so he got no credit for that. But, you know, we saw a new and improved Jay Cutler last year under Adam Gase, and they have some continuity there with Dowell Loghain sticking around as you know, gets the promotion from QB coach to offensive coordinator with Gase leaving for Miami. Did you see a different Jay Cutler last year, or was this just a matter of, you know, I don't know, the results not really matching the performance?
I thought he looked like a different guy. What Gase's system did, and Loghain's will continue it. He and Gase, Loghain's and Gase are good friends. They have a very similar viewpoint on football. It instilled discipline upon Cutler. So Cutler's problem has always been he's undisciplined. He's undisciplined in his mechanics and his decision-making, and that's why you see the ball go all over the field at times. And so they put more 3- and 5-step timing passes in there. They also did more wide receiver screens. Tactics that got the ball out of Cutler's hand in rhythm and on time. And over the course of a whole game, what that would do over the course of a season, over the course of all the practices, that made him a more patient, smarter player. I also think they didn't have a lot of weapons around Cutler last year. And so I think he had to play more disciplined, because they did rely more on the scheme to get the plays made rather than guys out executing the opponent.
Yeah.
So will that continue now with Kevin White back and healthy for the first time, and Alshon Jeffrey healthy again? I hope it does. It might not. We'll wait and see on that. But overall, I thought Cutler was sensational for him, because also, Gary, in the fourth quarter, late in games, when they needed him to be that playmaker or third down and long situations, he was still able to do that. He still had he's one of the best touch throwers in the league in the red zone, tight yeah. windows, yep. downfield touch. And of course he has the rocket arm. So expanded his game last year rather than redefining it, and I thought that was a great thing.
Yeah. Yeah, Kevin White comes back. He's got White and Jeffrey, a couple of big receivers to work in there. And, you know, we kind of, every year is a make-or-break year for Jay Cutler, it seems like, ever since he had that honeymoon in Chicago, that first season he was there, which seems like a lifetime ago now. But, you know, it seems like every year since it's been make-or-break for Cutler. It felt like we really meant it last year. And last year was the first year where it was like, oh, he did it. He was better. He was good this year. So it'll be it'll be interesting to see if he can carry that over this year. Now, I want to talk about Alex Smith again, because we were at number 14, and this is Andy Dalton. He got a 15 from you. He got a 9 from Irwin. He was my 17th, so he gets no credit for that. Andy Dalton was, my assessment is, he was dropped into the absolute perfect situation in Cincinnati. You know, he's got a great pass protecting line in front of him. He has, you know, he came into the league with AJ Green. I think Alex Smith's cautiousness is born out of a career of never having that sort of game changing receiver or you know, those sort of dynamic receivers to throw to who can sort of make up for your mistakes if you're, you know, if you're a little bit off on a throw or, you know. I think Andy Dalton's in a situation where he can essentially, you know, if things are going a little bit wrong, he can just chuck the thing in AJ Green's general vicinity and trust that AJ Green's going to make a play. Alex Smith has never had that, and I think that's why that's been sort of programmed out of him or deprogrammed out of him, if it was ever programmed out of him. But I think if Alex Smith had come out, whatever it was, 3 years later and dropped into this Bengals situation, I think he'd be a better quarterback than Andy Dalton is now. And that is my scorching hot take.
And see, I think AJ Green would be a much less productive receiver than he is now if Alex Smith had become his QB. I know what you're saying with Dalton. You could argue it hasn't been a good thing with Dalton to have that AJ Green 50-50 ball factor, because 28 of Dalton's interceptions before last season were targeting AJ Green, which is the most in the league from any one QB to one wide receiver. Now, they got that number down to 3 last year. Dalton played fewer games. I see Dalton as what Alex Smith could be if he were aggressive. Dalton is aided by the play designs quite a bit, but he is willing to work within the full confines of the play designs. He'll turn it loose, so to speak. He needs help by the play designs, but he'll turn it loose when the play designs present that to him. Alex Smith doesn't turn it loose. He leaves a lot of wide open guys on the field. Alex Smith needs bigger throwing windows.
Yeah. You remember how the Bengals used to always be, you know, it was like Mike Brown he doesn't put the resources into the scouting department, and, you know, they're running everything on the cheap, and how can they ever build a winner there? And you just look at the team they've built around Dalton there, and I mean, both sides of the ball. Pretty incredible.
I think there's a reason for that, Gary. It's the one thing they've had is the same head coach for several years now, a lot of years. He's been on a one-year contract, it seems like, every one of those years, but he's been there, Marvin Lewis. And they've had a lot of continuity within the coaching staff under Marvin Lewis. And you notice they almost always promote guys from within. They move like Paul Gunther, their D coordinator. He was their linebackers coach. Kenny Zampezi, their offensive coordinator, was their QB's coach. And there's a semblance of continuity there. And what goes along with that continuity and the small scouting department is the coaches are the ones that do the scouting now in Cincinnati. So the position coaches, like the receivers coach, goes out and scouts a lot of the wide receivers. And that puts a lot of burden on the coaches, but A, it gets those guys thinking football in different ways, which makes them easier to hire at other spots when the time comes. And B, it does save you money, but C, you've got your scouting department 100% in line with your coaches and what they want, because they are one and the same. And a lot of teams, one of their biggest issues is the scouts don't see the game the same way the coaches do, and so they're getting different types of players. The Bengals don't have that issue at all.
Mike Brown was on to something after all, maybe. Maybe on accident.
Well, and I think Duke Tobin, who heads their front office, I think he also does a pretty good job, too. Someone, there's still a front office. The coaches aren't drafting guys. Yeah. They're just filing the scouting reports.
No, it was just always the impression that, like, you know, the extent of their scouting was like, you know, when they all just sort of hang out and eat lunch on Saturday and, like, they're at the TGI Fridays and college football is playing on a couple of the TVs there. Now, it's not true, but that was the impression of how Mike Brown ran that organization for a little bit. But obviously, things are working out very well in Cincinnati. Very good team there. Andy, we get to pick up with more arguments with this next one. I get to yell at you. This is number 13, Matt Ryan. He was 12 for Andy, 12 for Jeff, 14 for me. And we'll pull back the curtain just a little bit. As some of you might know, Andy writes the extra point column at the MMQB. He started last year on it. That comes out on Mondays, along with Peter's big Monday morning quarterback column, Peter King's. Now, Peter and I, every once in a while, would talk about, like, oh, how's Andy doing with the column? And for the most part, it was great. And we'd say, boy, really like that Andy column. And we'd talk about it when I saw Peter on a Monday or a Friday when he was in the office. You wrote about Matt Ryan and the Falcons probably a third of the way into the year. And
I think it's about week 10, I think. It was a little bit deeper. Yeah.
It was – Peter came – that's right, because it was when they started – they were falling apart at that point. So, yeah, it probably was like mid-season or after. But, yeah, Peter came in the office and was just kind of like, what do you think of what Andy wrote on the Falcons? And I was like, it was weird. It wasn't his best work. And Peter was like, yeah, I didn't think it was very good. And I'm like, it was the only time it happened. All the columns you wrote last year was the only time that...
Well, this is the first time I'm hearing about it, too, so I don't know how much I believe you. That was the only time it happened. I remember that column, and, yeah, it wasn't very good. I agree with you guys.
But, yeah, I bring it up now because I remember we were both kind of like, you know, he just sort of made a lot of excuses for Matt Ryan over an extended...
yeah, I did.
You know, period of time here. And we were like, wasn't Matt Ryan really bad yesterday? It was the Colts game when he threw a couple red zone interceptions and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and they had one where I remember they had one backed up that he threw right to DeQuell Jackson that I think was an easy Colts touchdown.
Yep.
Here's what I wrote with that article in a nutshell, was that the Falcons, they started 5-0, which surprised me, and then they lost a whole bunch of their next few games. They basically became a 500 team after going 5-0. Like, yep. They fell to 500.
Yep.
And they had an abnormal number of turnovers inside the 20-yard lines, both backed up and when they were proceeding to get into field goal position and score. And a lot of the turnovers were fumbles and botched snaps and weird type of plays that as football outsiders loves to remind us, the data gathering site, they do a great job analyzing aggregate data, is fumbles are a 50-50 proposition pretty much. They happen, someone gets them, someone recovers, somebody doesn't. That's how it goes. So I just figured they're not going to keep fumbling in the scoring position like they have been all year. It's an aberration. That was wrong. And I went back and read all of my Falcons notes the other day as just part of my offseason preparation work. And reading their season again on the film notes from front to back, I thought, boy, Matt Ryan sure made a lot of really dumb decisions last year.
Yeah.
For given that he's a cerebral, really mechanically sound quarterback that runs an entire offense and does 2 minute and works at the line of scrimmage, given his standard, he makes way too many bonehead plays, and I think that was part of the problem. So there's Matt Ryan, but he's still 13th on our list. I had him 12th on mine.
Yeah.
He does need to clean things. He needs to clean up his game though a little bit. He'll throw 15 interceptions in a season, which isn't a ton, but about it seems like half of them are things that should just flat out never happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how much of his problems do you think were tied to the fact that, you know, first year in Kyle Shanahan's system last year?
It's a pretty user-friendly system. I don't think very many, because they do a lot. The system's built on play action and zone action, which that makes the game a little more straightforward. Play action tends to make your reads be either or type of reads. Mm-hmm. You're not doing full scanning field, full progression reads. And the other fact you have to keep in mind, they have Julio Jones. Now, they have nobody else around Julio, so the offensive line's not great. They have a running game, but if your O-line's not great, the running game's going to be sketchy.
Yep.
And they don't have other receiving threats. But when you have a guy like Julio, you do get the coverages can be regulated a little bit because you know where the safety's going to be helping to. So the game is – it's not a complex game, relatively speaking, for Matt Ryan. I bet he'd tell you he needs to play a little sharper.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's, they added Mohamed Sanu there, for better or worse, or
For the same. Neither. That'll be the same. Yeah. He'll be better than Roddy White, but Muhammad Sanu was a number three in Cincinnati, and I know they felt he couldn't play number two type snaps. They thought his reps had to be limited.
Yeah.
So we'll see. The Bengals know him better than the Falcons know him at this point still.
Yep. Yeah, so Ryan in 13th year and 12th, we have Ryan's draft classmate. This is Joe Flacco. He was 9th for Andy, 11th for me, not ranked for Irwin.
This is your first Irwin bomb, by the way. See, that's disruptive to the rankings. Joe Flacco ought to be probably 10, but yep. Irwin didn't do his job. Well, if Irwin had done his job, Flacco would be number 10. Flacco, Gary, can you explain to me why he has the reputation he has? Because he's a big arm QB. We all know that. He's a
yep.
prototypical big arm rocket throwing pocket passer type. He actually moves better than people realize. But he's also got the he's a winner thing working for him, which tends to be hogwash. But in his case, he's the most successful postseason quarterback, one of the most of all time,
yeah.
winning percentage wise. And he even culminated that with a Super Bowl in 2012, which probably was the best postseason run for any QB of all time. And yet we think of him as always old boring old Joe, which
yeah.
also is not – that's not true either, by the way. He's very honest and very upfront and on the shirt sleeve with his emotions. He just doesn't have very wide-ranging emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's – look, there's certainly a you know, lack of charisma is the – you know, is the impression that he leaves, and that plays into it. But it's also the fact that, you know, when he came into the league, it was Ray Lewis's defense. It was Ray Lewis's team. It was those Ravens defenders. And, you know, Ed Reed was still there, and Terrell Suggs, and those were the headliners on that team. And Flacco was kind of the, you know, all right, don't mess it up, quarterback, you know, type of guy.
Yep.
And similarly, I mean, look, Tom Brady used to have a similar reputation as, you know, he's just a winner. He might not be the most talented guy in the world, but he's just a winner. And then Brady finally had that insane record-setting season with the 50 touchdown passes. And that's when people, you know, finally took notice that, oh, Tom Brady, yeah, he's actually, you know, he's an all-time great. He's not like the super game manager type of guy who just wins. He's also an exceedingly talented quarterback, so... I think Flacco kind of falls victim to that, and you know, he's the one. And you mentioned arm strength, and you know, there's a when Flacco came into the league, he was a guy he could get the ball to the perimeter, and that was sort of his strength. I think he had some trouble sort of picking through the moving bodies in the middle of the field, and that was a limitation for him. But you know, he's a complete quarterback at this point, and people don't realize, you know, arm strength can be a, you know, sort of a, I don't know, some people see it as almost like a knock, like, you know, he's just a big arm guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
No, it's important. It matters. Yeah. Arm strength matters a lot, and it's not just how he throws the ball really far, it's that he gets the ball from A to B quickly, and
exactly.
The quicker you can get it, the more options you have as a passer, and the more options your offense has in the passing game.
Exactly. You know, it's sort of seen as this, like, brawn over brains type of thing when you see
a
big arm guy. But, you know, he's good. He's really good. I won't say the other word that people say along with Joe Flacco's name that...
he's elite. I'll say it. He's elite.
He's very, very...
How do you feel about... Do you think our next guy is elite? I guess you don't because you had him ranked 12th and I had him ranked 11th and Irwin had him 8th.
Yeah, we are at Tony Romo. There's always so much to unwrap with Tony Romo. And I guess we'll start with just right now, how do you view him? You know, he's coming off the collarbone injury. He's at a point in his career where he's not a, you know, carrier offense, throw it 45 times this week type of guy. The Cowboys, you know, they're not going to win games doing that, or they hope they don't have to do that. But, you know, where does he stand right now as far as his strengths as a quarterback?
He's much more of a complementary player right now. You're right. And that is his strength. And he can really thrive in that way because what people don't think about with Romo is how good he has gotten before the snap at orchestrating things at the line of scrimmage, adjusting protections, audibles. He's become a very cerebral quarterback. It translates to post-snap as well. especially when they're ahead in the down and distance, and he's not having to play from behind. And he's capable of playing from behind still, too. He's not Alex Smith. He's Alex Smith who takes risks and is capable of taking risks.
All right, well, Romo coming in at 11. Andy, we're going to take a 27-second break, and we'll be back with the top 10 quarterbacks in football. It's finally here. NFL training camps are open, and we are fired up. That's true for the MMQB, as well as our colleagues over at the Audible's NFL podcast. SI senior writer Don Banks and host Andrew Perloff are delivering football insight and a lot of laughs. You can find the Audible's NFL podcast on your favorite podcast app or on si.com/podcasts. All right, we're diving right back into the top 10 quarterbacks in football. Number 10, and this is one, I'll hear your explanation on this, Andy, but Russell Wilson comes in at 10. He is 13 for you. He was 8 for me. He was 5 for Irwin, so a bit of a range here on Russell Wilson. I mean, I'll just open it up. You know, you've been a little lukewarm on Wilson over the years. Why is he not a guy who should be considering that sort of like top 4 or 5 class?
Well, what makes me struggle with Russell Wilson is he's the best playmaker in the NFL, I think. But for as many plays as he makes, he leaves a lot on the field, kind of like the Alex Smith thing a little bit. It's not that he won't take chances. I think he doesn't see well from the pocket. And being undersized like that, he's never learned to play from the pocket, and so his instinct is to leave the pocket.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when he does, look, again, when he does that, he is as hard to defend as anyone in the league. But he also makes himself easier to defend because he'll abandon play designs that had worked. And so while Russell Wilson is really hard to play against because of how he runs around, he's also equally as hard at times to play with because of that. And it's just it's a fine line that you walk. And Seattle, I think, has done a good job working around it. And yet you can only work around it so much.
Well, I'll ask you this about Wilson. And this was another column you wrote last year. They sort of revamped what they did the Steelers game last year. It was right after Thanksgiving. They went a lot more spread, a lot more timing throws, a lot more. You know, it was Wilson became a pocket passer in that system after that. If you took, you know, the last 2 months of last season and sort of projected it over the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years, are we looking at a guy who's one of the best, 4 or 5 quarterbacks in football sort of in that discussion for number one?
If Russell Wilson plays like he did, starting week 11, but as you say, against the Niners, but as you said, especially week 12 against the Steelers, that's where it fully clicked. Mm-hmm. And he plays like, what's happened there is he played from the pocket. It's like all of a sudden he just woke up one day and he was a pocket passer. And they aided him in that regard by calling more spread formations that had him get the ball out super quick, like faster than 3-step timing. And you can play that way when you spread out because the defense can't disguise, and so it's safer to play fast because the coverages are become more predictable and the defense spreads with you. If Russell Wilson plays like that consistently, then he's a top 3 quarterback, I think, for sure, because he doesn't lose the playmaking element. He can still do that when he has to, but he was sensational in those last few weeks. Now, what gives me pause, and it's a big if he can play like that, because what gives me pause is that he didn't necessarily play that way in week 17 against the Rams, and at times he didn't play that way in the postseason either. So will he revert back to some of his old instincts and play only Sandlot type of football? If he does, I think the discussion about him stays where it is, where it has been. If he doesn't, though, if he does become what he looked like he was in December, then yeah, he's unstoppable.
Yep. Well, Wilson comes in at 10, a couple more. Well, let's call these guys traditional pocket passers. At number 9 and number 8, we'll sort of group them together. We have Eli Manning at 9. He was 8 for Andy, 10 for me, 11 for Jeff. And Phillip Rivers at 8. Andy had him 10. I had him 5, and Irwin had him at 10. And we'll start with Eli, who I thought was especially mistake-prone at the wrong moments last year, but at the same time, you know, he looked much more comfortable in Ben McAdoo's system. I mean, when you see a guy do that, he just, you know, he had, I believe you would term it brain farts at all the wrong times, late in games, you know, famously the week one throwing the ball away when they were trying to run the clock down and, you know, giving the Cowboys that last drive to beat them down in Dallas. Do you sort of write those off as anomalies, or is this a larger trend that you see with Eli over the years?
Manning does that once in a while. I think we've seen that, and you kind of live with it. It's what makes it a little different than Matt Ryan, I think, is that, well, it's not a whole lot different than Matt Ryan. Manning has such command of the game at the line of scrimmage, post-snap. He makes a lot more good decisions than bad ones. We forget that, too, because the brain farts. The Giants are on national TV a lot. The brain farts, that's what stands out. Those get replayed more. But just from a down-to-down basis, Manning is very much in command of the game. And I think he will be a lot better in year two under McAdoo. Keep in mind, in that system, they had to change a lot of his mechanics to accommodate the quicker timing. They do two- and four-step timing there at McAdoo. It's the Packer philosophy rather than three- and five-step timing. Manning will be – he's going to be more comfortable there now this season. So I like him. And then as far as Rivers goes – Rivers is the theme of this show, Gary, is quarterbacks that are good before the snap, that have command of the offense, because that's Rivers' game as well. And he's exceptional when bodies are coming at him unblocked. He is very tough in the pocket, and his anticipation throwing outside the numbers, corner patterns, outside routes, he anticipates zone windows opening up outside the numbers as well as any guy in the league. I think that's one reason Antonio Gates runs so many corner patterns in their system. I think there's a lot to like with Rivers as well. One other thing about him, he gets to his checkdowns very smoothly and very quickly. And that seems he's not playing. If you get your checkdown on time or even a little bit early, a lot of times you catch the defense still in retreat mode. And that's a big advantage. And Danny Woodhead last year, San Diego's third down back, he led all NFL running backs in receiving. Mm-hmm. That was a big, big part of their offense. Rivers has an unbelievable ability to find his checkdown and understand, hey, I see what's covered. I already know I'm going to have to go to my checkdown. I'm just going to get there early and go there now because all the other routes are covered. He can recognize what's not open as well as any QB in the NFL, and that's also half the battle.
Yeah. I'd like to see Philip Rivers have one more season where everyone in his receiving corps stays in one piece. Just like to see him, you know, have guys to throw it to.
He had nothing around him last year. It was awful. His old line was broken down due to injury, and his receiving corps was as well, and his rookie running back wasn't ready to play. So they had no shot last year. And yet, I think we've talked about San Diego. I never felt like I was watching an uncompetitive team. I thought they were very competitive. I thought they were a professional-looking team week in and week out still.
Yep. Well, Rivers comes in at 8. At 7, we have Andrew Luck. Now, Andrew Luck is in Andy Benoit darling. Andy had him 4th. I had him 6th. Irwin had him 13th. And Irwin sort of emphasizes that the – oh, I'll just flat out read this. By the analytics community, Luck has been underwhelming. He was the lowest-rated starter by PFF in 2015. In fact, only Zach Mettenberger rated lower among all QBs, et cetera, et cetera. More numbers that are not flattering in regards to Andrew Luck's 2015 performance. I don't know exactly what to think of Luck at this point. I give him the benefit of the doubt at this point. Andy, you've been a huge fan of Luck since he came to the league. Does last year give you any pause?
No, none.
None?
No pause, because the first three seasons were so overwhelmingly positive. I think you go three beats one considerably in my book. And what Luck does need to do differently based on last season, I think he does need to get rid of the ball on time a little more often. Now, that's a tough one, because what makes him special is his ability to extend plays within the pocket. So we've been talking timing passers here. Luck's not a timing passer. He can be, but his game is when things break down. And breakdown's really the wrong term, because I think what makes him unique – so Russell Wilson, for example, we say he extends plays. He extends plays by breaking down the play.
Yeah.
Luck extends plays by not breaking down the play. He'll stay within the pocket. He'll keep the structure of the play around him alive and still go through his progressions within the same context of how the progressions were drawn up. So there's an inherent structure that stays with Luck in that offense, even when you get very late in the play, when almost any other QB would go into complete sandlot mode at that moment. Now, that's the double-edged sword, because that makes him special. In fact, I think he's the best in the league at that, maybe tied with Roethlisberger, of maintaining a play structure when things break down. But that also is what makes him vulnerable to taking hits up the middle. Yeah. You're going to leave your body exposed that way, and he paid a price last year. And Indianapolis, they've improved the interior of that offensive line a little bit, but they're not all the way there yet. And so they're still going to be vulnerable to the inside pressure stunts and twists and blitzes that they saw a year ago, which means Luck, the only way to combat that, he's going to have to be a little more judicious when he extends plays and be a little more selective there.
Yeah. I mean, they can program that out of him, right? I would assume.
I don't know if you can. I think you can in certain scenarios, and it's a first and second down thing. I don't know if you can on third down and long, which is when quarterbacks, that's usually when they make or break as players.
Okay. All right. Well, Andrew Luck coming in at 7, at 6. Another interesting case here, Carson Palmer. He was 6 on your list, 9 on mine, 4th on Irwin. So Palmer, great fit in Bruce Arians' offense. He is the kind of risk-taking deep thrower that Arians wants. And, you know, you could say, you know, it's a great system. Palmer's great. When Palmer went down a couple years ago, you know, they were sort of okay with Drew Stanton, and then Stanton went down, and they couldn't find a guy to move the ball at all. So there's something to be said for that as far as Palmer's maintaining his value and maintaining his skills at this point in his career. He hurt his thumb late last year, and I wonder if that really had a big effect on his struggles late in the year, or, you know, there's a narrative with him that sometimes the moment can get too big. Whatever you think of it, obviously the NFC title game was a disaster for him, and
a lot of other Cardinals too. There were a lot of other guys that had bad games that day.
The divisional game was pretty shaky too, though, and, you know, if Larry Fitzgerald doesn't have that catch and run, they might be losing to a not particularly good Packers team at home. And
can I interrupt you right there, though?
Go for it,
I get what
Andy.
You're saying. So that Larry Fitzgerald catch and run play, and this is a great illustration of Palmer. I believe he was the number 3 option in that route progression. Green Bay blitzed. When you blitz, a quarterback's not going to get to his third option, especially a blitz up the middle, which Green Bay does a lot, and they did on that play.
Mm-hmm.
Palmer recognized the blitz before the snap, eluded the blitz because he recognized it, and at that point, after which eluding it, that's not his game, but so he's making a play there, and that was an impressive play.
Yeah.
At that point, any other quarterback would have just gone into panic mode and try to get something else out, gain 5 yards on the run, throw it away even if he could, or just dial into the first or second read. Palmer knew that because of where the blitz came from and where Fitzgerald's route was going, there's no one that could run with Fitzgerald at that point. He saw Julius Peppers dropping back into zone coverage, but Peppers could not have seen Fitzgerald's route. He's not going to run with Fitzgerald anyway.
Yeah.
So in the heat of that moment, Palmer made the play. It's a little dump off and Fitzgerald gets to catch and run, but it's a little dump off that the quarterback made on a third progression that he never should have gotten to in the first place, but he got there because he recognized the blitz concept and adjusted his approach accordingly. That is unbelievable quarterbacking, and that's what Carson Palmer does on a regular basis. And a lot of times it looks so much smoother than that, we don't even notice. But Arizona, for example, they use more empty backfield formations than any team in the NFL. Well, when you go empty and someone blitzes you, which a lot of teams check to blitz, when they see a lot of defenses, when they see that you have nobody in the backfield with the quarterback, they're going to blitz you automatically. Well, the quarterback then has to beat the blitz and has to know where to go with the ball and has to see the blitz and has to have the toughness to stand in there and make the throw. And not only does Palmer do that, but he'll make those throws at the deep and intermediate levels, 18 yards on a dime. The types of throws, the throws that bothers me that Alex Smith doesn't look at. Alex Smith couldn't make 80% of the throws that Palmer attempts in that Arizona offense.
And had to bring it back to Alex Smith, huh?
Yeah, because we're talking, we're now, while we're in the top 5 and 6 now, yeah.
Now it's personal. I'm redoing my poll and putting Alex Smith number one.
That would be a Jeff Irwin move. Irwin had Palmer 4, so you had him 9, so we're all kind of in agreement on Palmer. You're a little off, but yeah, that's all right.
Well, we'll see. I'm looking forward.
As far as that big moment thing,
yeah,
you're right. It's the big moment thing. I can't talk about that. It might be true, it might not, but there's no way for any of us to know that. So yeah. I feel like, as a responsible analyst, I'd just be guessing, which would be irresponsible.
All right. Well, we'll end it on that. Also, because we have to take a 30-second break, after which we will come back with the top 5 quarterbacks in football. The world's best athletes are converging on Rio for the Summer Olympics, and SI has a special channel that will bring you all the top stories in podcast form as they happen. Just go to your podcast app of choice and search Sports Illustrated Olympic Channel. You can also visit SI.com/Olympics for SI's complete coverage of the Rio Games. All right, this is it. Top 5. 5th is Drew Brees. He was 7th for you and for me, and he was 3rd for Irwin. I think with Brees, it's just kind of a question of what do you think he has left. The arm strength is dwindling, but
yes,
then, you know, obviously he's come up with a way to compensate for that because he is just delivering some monster performances like you saw last December. But, you know, I guess you could have put Brees anywhere in this top 5 to 3, or maybe even 2 or 1 range, but I don't know.
Yeah, 2 or 1's a bit high, don't you think? Yeah, you had him 7.
Yeah.
The arm strength is dwindling, and New Orleans has a very vertical passing game, so what happens now? Well, for one, the arm strength dwindled last year. In fact, it was very bad at times when his shoulder was hurt, and the Saints still got downfield. They tied with Jacksonville for the NFL high of passes that went 20 yards or more. They had 72 of those. Yeah.
Interesting.
So they were still – yeah, their system still maintained. I think the reason for that, they attack between the numbers a lot. Their passing game takes place in the middle of the field, and defenses will tell you that preparing for the Saints – you game plan to stop them in the middle of the field. Now, some of that's because that's Brees' strength. Those are easier throws. They don't require the arm strength. And Brees has always had a good arm, but never a gun. But another part of that is that's where it's harder to defend the middle of the field if you can attack it right as an offense. And they do. They do a great job. And I think it's because Brees can manipulate safeties with his body language better than any QB in the NFL. And I had this guy at a lunch with, like, 3 or 4 quarterbacks coaches all at once at the combine this past year, and it was a blast. And hearing them talk about the value and the significance of being able to manipulate safeties and also zone defenders, any defender that's watching you as a quarterback,
yeah,
to manipulate them with your body language, your flinching of the shoulders, your subtle pump fakes, your eyes, your helmet movement. That is the highest level of quarterbacking there is, because it's a physical it's a physical dimension and what's really a mental part of the game. So you got to be completely comfortable with the system around you and everything you're seeing. And once you are, then you're comfortable enough to work on those nuanced elements of quarterbacking. All of those guys think Brees does it better than anyone in the league.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, if you take an offense that attacks the middle of the field, then it would make sense that the quarterback would have to be really good at manipulating the safety with his body language. Why I share this is because, A, I think this makes up Brees' game, but mm-hmm. B, this will help offset the diminishment of the arm strength. He's not going to beat safeties with his arm anymore, but he can still beat them with the rest of his body language.
Can I throw out a crackpot theory as to why Well, I'll just say the crackpot theory, because you can't stop me, Andy. So I wonder if his ability to manipulate defenders with his body language, I wonder if that's actually an advantage to his short stature, whereas guys physically can't see him in the backfield as well as they could a guy who's 6'4", 6'5".
I see what you're saying. I think it's a necessity with his stature. In order to play from the pocket, he has to do something to adjust, to control that safety still, because with the short stature, that can inhibit the throwing. You're not going to be as strong arm naturally, and your trajectory becomes different, because throwing it at 6 feet is different than throwing it 6'5". So where your ball flies from is different. So it'd be interesting. I'm hoping to actually do a story on this at some point and talk to Breeze about it. I don't know when that will be. But I would love to – I don't know. That's a question for him to ask him, because he would know the answer to that.
All right. All right, well, Drew Brees at 5. At 4, we have the reigning MVP, Cam Newton. He was a 5 for Andy, 3 for me, and 6 for Jeff. And I will once again reference an Andy Benoit article at the top of this. So you wrote one of the best things off the Super Bowl last year for that following Monday morning, where you were in the Broncos locker room and you essentially asked Brandon Marshall and a couple of other guys, what did the Panthers do differently? What wrinkles did they show you? And it sounded like you were there. I was not there, but from editing and reading your piece, I got the sense that the Broncos had sort of a good laugh at this point and said they did nothing. They did nothing different. They showed us nothing new. We were not surprised by anything they did, despite the fact that the Panthers had 2 weeks to prepare for this game. And I just wonder with Cam, I wonder if, and look, I hate to get into the whole psychology of Cam Newton and all that, and you know, but I wonder if there was sort of an approach where the Panthers said, you know, let's not pile too much on this guy this week. Let's do what we've done because it's worked, and we don't want to, you know, we don't want to throw off, you know, what he's gotten used to at this point.
Possibly, and I tread lightly with Cam Newton because I don't want to bump into psychology either. I bring that up because I was wrong about Newton last season. I thought before the season I wrote, I tweeted, whatever it was, I said he'll be the same QB now that he'll be the same QB in 5 years that he is now.
Yeah.
Because he'd been the same QB for his first 4 seasons. So I don't regret saying that, but he obviously proved me wrong. But in the Super Bowl, he did go back to being that same QB. And what the same QB looked like, very talented. We know what he does for their running game, not just as a ball carrier, but as a threat as a ball carrier. And they do a good job of building around him to emphasize that. So we know that. But as a passer from the pocket, his mechanics waver. And he gets very undisciplined at times. With his footwork, he'll just be, as my friend Greg Cosell calls it, an armor of the ball. He just throws with his arm and nothing else.
Yep.
And that's why his accuracy can be wild. He calmed that this past season. He was great from the pocket. His decision-making improved with it. But that fell apart in the Super Bowl. And I don't know why that is. And what you also hear, we saw it with the media, but you also hear kind of behind the scenes that emotionally he fell apart as well. And he was kind of immature, unapproachable, petulant Cam again.
Yeah.
And so that I'm concerned about that. I hope he can keep proving me wrong, because it's fun to have a guy like this in the NFL. But that Super Bowl was bad. That was a really, really bad showing in a lot of ways for him. And look, let's hope he bounces back. He still made the Super Bowl, but he's got to bounce back. That was a bad game, a really bad game.
Yeah, I think on the plus side, I mean, look, you know, no one's going to sit here and say, oh, do the Broncos have the blueprint for stopping Cam? And, you know, the blueprint
is
have Von Miller.
They did, but the Broncos will tell you they did have one blueprint, and that was that they did what you call green dog blitzes, which I know this sounds way specific, but it was the difference in the Super Bowl. So the Panthers use a lot of extra bodies in pass protection. They keep an extra tight end, often an extra running back in there, and that's why their passing game is so vertical. It goes really far downfield because they maximize the protection, and Newton's able to play in the pocket. Well, what happens when you're in man coverage and you've got the tight end who stays in and blocks, or you've got the running back who stays in and blocks? What do you do as the man-to-man defender then? The Broncos made those guys blitzers. That's green-dogging them. Most teams had not done that to Carolina all year long. In fact, the only team that really had shown Carolina consistent types of pressure were the Falcons in late in the year, who beat them with that approach. They rushed five a lot of the times. So Denver, they realized no one's gone after the guy. They've all reacted because they're afraid a Cam's going to scramble on him if the blitzer misses on the tackle. But Denver said, forget it, let's roll with it, let's do it, and it worked. I think that is the blueprint. Now maybe it gets defeated, but Broncos will tell you, you got to go after Cam, and no one had done that until them last year.
Well, whatever happens on opening night, you know there will be big, broad conclusions drawn about Cam Newton off that game.
Absolutely. That's why guys like us have jobs.
Yep, absolutely. So Cam Newton comes in at 4. We have a tie for 2 here, and we'll start with Aaron Rodgers because we'll get to the other guy at, well, you'll see why we'll hold him for a second, but Aaron Rodgers is in 2nd here, and no Jordy Nelson last year. So I always point to the fact that, you know, analysts who say, oh, you know, Rodgers should be accurate regardless. You know, he should have completed passes regardless. You know, I think when you're security blanket is gone, the guy you're most comfortable with, I think it throws off everything you do, and I think you saw that with Rodgers last year where he was never comfortable. And, you know, it's the same thing with guys, to bring up Tim Tebow again. Tim Tebow's problem was always he had no idea what he was looking at in the middle of the field. And it's not an intelligence thing. You can be perfectly intelligent, but if your mind just doesn't properly map what's happening in front of you, it's a problem. When you're trying to place a ball into a very tight window. But I thought that was the issue with Rodgers last year. I'd be surprised if he didn't bounce back under the assumption that Jordy Nelson will be 100% this year.
Rodgers' passer rating to Nelson is off the charts, isn't it? Isn't it like in the 130s or 40s even? So, yeah, there's data that totally backs up what you're saying. With Nelson out of the lineup, Green Bay's other receivers could not get open against man coverage. End of story. They couldn't get open. And the coaches, frankly, did a horrible job of giving them play designs to help them get open. That's not naturally part of Green Bay's offense. They tend to be more of an isolation route offense. It works for them until the receivers stop doing their job. So I concur with what you're saying. I will say Rodgers, to his part, though, has to play more disciplined as well. Yeah. There were times where there were 6-yard passes that he would have been attempting a few years ago that he just totally lost faith in, didn't trust the protection probably, certainly didn't trust his receivers, and so he became a very off-schedule player. He's magical off-schedule. We know that. He had 7 big-time completions last year on plays where he drew the defense offsides and just made it a random play because they were offsides. We saw the Hail Mary plays. Those were a great microcosm of the season. Your plays didn't work all game long. Rodgers on the last play just makes an unbelievable throw that nobody else can make, and it happened to work, and so you get to win the game. That's not high-level football, and that's not going to produce playoff appearances regularly. So he's got to get more on schedule, and there's got to be a happy medium between being Rodgers the magician and Rodgers the professional quarterback. He's had that medium for most years. He did not have it last year, though.
Yeah, and just for record-keeping, Rodgers was 2nd for me, 2nd for Irwin, 3rd for Andy. So Andy's really down on him. And tied with Rodgers for 2nd, Tom Brady. Andy and I both gave Brady our first place vote. Irwin had him 7th. And look, I live in one of the New England states, so I feel I just have to put it out there. I think Brady is number 1. But Irwin's explanation: he rated out poorly by QBR. I assume that is ESPN's quarterback rating system.
Yeah, and it's totally flawed, by the way, too. I love ESPN. They're great. They're great competitors. Their system is stupid.
I like the overall theory of that system. I do not think they have components as part of it.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't. Do they still weighted at points to fourth quarter performance?
Yeah.
So that's flawed. No coach in the history of the NFL has ever come up with a game plan that says, hey, guys, listen, we're going to be great in the fourth quarter. We're not going to work. The goal of this week is to be great in the fourth quarter. That's not how you play football. The goal is to be great from snap to snap and let the game play out. And if you need to be great in the fourth, you can be great in the fourth.
And Irwin reiterates that his 5-7, which went Wilson, Newton, Brady, was very close. And look, these guys had 54 points. The number one guy had 55. So obviously, this
whatever
very
and all
easily,
this stuff.
But I'm just putting out the full dossier of information here, Andy. But Tom Brady, he's very, very good. I think he had some struggles once the Patriots ran out of human beings to play a wide receiver last year, and Gronk was out, And I wrote him a letter saying I'd go out there, I'd go up to Foxborough, and I'd play some receiver, and I never heard back. But I guess that's on them.
Brady has done, he's had more success in a wider range of different systems than any QB I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And you talked about Brady pre-2007. What's interesting is Brady, he was a winner for the early part of his career, which is like a kind of a backhanded compliment almost. Then he had the big statistical year, but he stopped winning Super Bowls for a while. He's a better QB now than he was when he was winning titles three out of 4 years, which shows you just how fine of line there is between being a quote-unquote champion and being a really good player. So it's, we could talk all day about Brady. We're not going to talk about the ancillary stuff or the peripheral stuff with him. I don't feel like I have to explain or justify having Tom Brady up at number one. He owns his system. He's owned about four other systems before that. They do a great job of, let's just put it this way. We just talked about Aaron Rodgers, and he lost Jordy Nelson, and look what happened. Brady, have we ever said that about Brady, where if it's just one guy, the whole system alters? Maybe the system alters, but Brady doesn't alter. He's not dependent on guys around him. He makes the guys around him. And the best example is what they do with those slot receivers to get them mismatched against zone defenders or man coverage beating combinations. Brady's the guy behind all of that. They take average guys and turn them into stars there in New England because of the way they play, the style they play, and the one common denominator is the man throwing the football. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why that Eagles game was so stunning last year, because you just never thought you'd reach a point where Brady couldn't, you know, you thought you'd never be able to find a collection of NFL players that Brady couldn't dominate with. And finally, you saw him have an off game when they were down to, you know, their basically their practice squad going out there with him. And
That game, they still scored 28 that game, and the Eagles had 21 on special teams or touchdown returns on defense. And some of that was on Brady. He had a bad interception. He had two really bad interceptions that game. Brady's not flawless, but I know what you're saying. I agree with you. And I will defend Tom Brady to the death.
Yeah. He had a great catch in that game, though. He had a long catch and run on a trick play.
Yeah, he did. Yep, you're right. He did.
He does it
all. I was at that game. That was the only game I attended last year other than the Super Bowl.
You went to Foxborough for that Eagles game?
Well, Peter made me go to New York for our MMQB holiday party, which was very convenient in the film study process, because cross-country flight. So I thought I'd better do something else while I'm over there. So I went to Foxborough.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Good time up there. So Brady and Rodgers tied for second, and number one is Ben Roethlisberger. He got Irwin's first place vote. He got a 2 from Andy. He got a 4 from me. Andy mentions Jeff mentions, ooh, that was a bad one. Jeff Irwin mentions, ranked second by PFF, second in QBR last season, which was a career high. I actually thought Roethlisberger was a little bit shaky late in the year, very specifically the Ravens. And even the Browns, when they clinched the playoff spot, they didn't exactly blow the Browns off the field. And that was a Cleveland team that was, you know, not really competitive for a while. So, he's great. He's fantastic. But, I'll throw it to you, Andy, and I'll ask, you know, Roethlisberger always had the reputation early in his career as a guy who just made plays late in downs. He, just sort of shed tacklers and spun out of tackles, stepped out of tackles, and then just made the late improv plays and downs. But he's a lot more than that now.
So, to bring everything full circle, we've talked about Russell Wilson and his unbelievable playmaking ability. And then we say, well, Wilson also got better in the pocket. What happens from there? What can he become? That's Roethlisberger. Roethlisberger got better in the pocket, but then we take it one step further. He got better in the pocket because he was always very good late in the down, even in the pocket, kind of like Andrew Luck. But then we take it one step further from that. Well, he's also gotten so much better in the pre-snap phase, which the Matt Ryan factor, Tony Romo, Manning, Brady, all these guys were talking about. Roethlisberger's in that discussion with them, and that's why they do so many spread formations now in Pittsburgh. So take Russell Wilson, take what we've seen with him over the years, and then take what we saw with him against Roethlisberger's team, where he was sensational from the pocket. Marry those two things, add in some of these pre-snap geniuses that we're seeing, the guys that can get you in and out of the right play calls and read your mail before the snap, as they say. And then make, and by the way, the guy now we're talking about, he's 6'5", 250, yeah, and he can make all the throws. So add the Flacco factor. That's what Roethlisberger is. He is, he's a conjunction of all these different types of quarterbacks rolled into one.
Well, there you go. I think that's a, I really like the read your mail metaphor there. I never heard that, Andy. That was a good one.
Thank you. John Gruden.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I think, I'm pretty sure. I think it may be it's him or one of his cronies, one of his acolytes.
Yeah. Well, that's going to do it. Ben Roethlisberger, by our collective measure, best quarterback in football. You may disagree with it, Andy and I do, but hey, that's where we are. Roethlisberger number one, and that concludes the off-season position rankings for our podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you especially for anyone who listened to most, if not all, of these. We really appreciate you guys. We will be back next week with the normal show. Andy and I are not going anywhere because the season is starting. Reach out to us, Twitter, ggramling_si or Andy_Benoit, Facebook, or talkback@themmqb.com. And we will figure out something else to talk about a week from now, Andy. Football, perhaps. Actual football.
Looking forward to it.
All right. This was the MMQB Podcast.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.